everyone. Welcome back to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I am Michelle Zeman, your podcast host. Please be sure to listen out for those two code words so that way you can get your free CEUs. I am very excited about today's episode. I'm going to be speaking with Jessica Wilson here from the Wellness and Behavior Collective, a little bit about trauma-informed care, talking a little bit about training educators as social emotional facilitators and yoga instructors. And we're going to be bringing it back to behavior analysis and bringing it back to how we can make our practice more informed, but then also more client-centered. So welcome to the podcast, Jessica. I'm super excited to have you here.
Thank you. I'm so excited.
Yeah. So first question that I'd love to discuss today is just tell us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your journey.
Sure. Yeah. So I have been in the field of behavior analysis, started taking classes in ABA about 11 years ago, I think. And that was the moment where I kind of started to like shift my whole perspective about being a human. I was like, oh my gosh, we can change our behavior. This is amazing. I was so excited and really just like dove right in. I worked as a special educator in self-contained classrooms. I've also worked in homes as a school-based BCBA. So got experience in a number of different settings, social skills groups, all of that. So spent a good amount of time doing that. And then I ended up working in the school system near me as a behavior facilitator supporting teachers. And I just kept seeing the same theme of burnout really being a barrier to what the work that I was doing, consulting that way. So and for myself, for everyone around me. So something I became really passionate about was shifting into more trauma-informed practices and really mitigating against the effects of burnout, trauma, et cetera, in the places that we work in as behavior analysts.
I'm really interested in learning more, especially because, you know, trauma is something that we really need to look at a lot more in our field. You know, we mm-hmm. might ask, have you ever had a history of trauma, or has your child ever had a history of trauma? But trauma is rooted in so many different areas. It's not just neglect and abuse. There's these huge elements that are also included, changes in everyday life, mm-hmm. any specific environmental changes. That being said, you know, many people might be trauma aware, but not trauma informed. What do you think the right. difference is, and how can we identify them better?
Yeah, so I've definitely like had those conversations with folks who are like, yeah, I know trauma exists. And that's where it ends, right? It's like, yeah, that's important. I'm like, okay, but what are we going to, how are we going to address this? And then there's that conversation of like, well, that's not our role, but it's part of this individual's life that we are working with. And it's impacting, you know, over 70% of Americans have experienced some form of trauma. And like you were saying, it's not just one thing. We can't just say, oh, that was a traumatic event. That's not really it, right? It's the events that somebody might experience and then how they go through that and how that experience, you know, impacts their belief system, their body, their brain, their nervous system, and then how it affects them. You know, somebody can go through the same event alongside another individual and say, yeah, that was traumatic for me. And the other person can say, oh, that was not that big of a thing for me. Those can be really impacted by so many different factors. I think it's really important to keep in mind, especially when we're asking families about that too. It's like, they might not even know that what they've experienced is not okay, not safe,
yeah.
right? Not impacting them. So yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. The question that I typically will ask families, like whenever I'm doing, like an initial assessment or whenever I'm doing like a reauth or even like throughout services, especially if I don't know the client, especially if I've not met them before, I'll ask the question of, we know that trauma can be abuse and neglect, but there are other elements of trauma to consider, such as significant changes. Something as significant as a placement change in their classroom. And I remember in particular, one family opened up to me about a change that happened in their daughter's school, where she was moved from one specific type of class to another specific type. And for her, that was very traumatic because she kept resisting going to that class. She did not feel safe in that class. She did not feel like she could be herself in that class. She wanted to be with a different set of peers where she knows that she could be more psychologically safe. So it really does just sort of show that trauma is not just, abuse, neglect. It's not those two things alone. That's completely mythical, or that's a myth, you
Right.
know?
Yeah. I think people think, oh, trauma is this like it is awful. It's really hard to go through those things, but I think there's this idea that it has to be this really dark, twisty, like abuse neglect situation, right? But it's like you're saying she had to go into another environment and mask who she is, right? And she couldn't fit, in that environment and feel psychologically safe. There's this idea of like trauma being too much, too soon, too fast, like too overwhelming for somebody, or not enough, not receiving enough of what they really need as a human. And there's no like meaning making around it. So there's no, oh, this was like the context, like understanding the context, and this is why this happened, rather than, for developmentally for kids too, they tend to internalize everything. Like this was my fault. This because of me, right? And that can just impact so many ways that you show up in the world. And I'm realizing too that like with the distinction too between like trauma aware and trauma informed, I didn't go into the trauma informed piece, but just like acknowledging that trauma informed is where we're actually shifting and making changes based on that information that trauma is so prevalent and pervasive.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why we do have to pay attention to trauma, not just be aware of, hey, this is traumatic for them. It's how can we help them through this trauma? How can we help our client? And it's in our code, we're expected to provide an individualized service. If we have clients with specific types of trauma and we're working on addressing those, that's individualized, so that's
Right.
really important.
Yeah, and I think, it's important too, like from the trauma-informed standpoint, I take that standpoint for everyone that I work with, regardless of if I know everything that's happened to them. I think that's a really important distinction because I've heard people say, well, I'm taking a trauma-informed approach with this client because I know that they've experienced trauma. That's, I don't think, fair to other people who, are not even capable of or have the capacity to share those things about their life, right? And
Absolutely.
it's like, how can we shift the perspective to, okay, trauma-informed isn't just for the individual that we're working with that we know that they're experiencing or have experienced trauma, and shift it to this is just the approach that we take from a global standpoint and organizational standpoint for clients and for staff.
Absolutely. I'm really glad you say that because, we might sit here and we might say, like, oh, I know that my client has been through significant trauma. I'm going to go the trauma-informed approach. But that being said, even if your client hasn't been through those types of changes or hasn't had any sort of trauma, that doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a trauma-informed approach.
Yes.
What if something happens within the realm of whether that be our services or just something that happens outside of our services that could be traumatic for them? We don't know. You know, we want to make sure that we're as informed as possible. And, you know, again, whether they have had trauma or not, that doesn't mean that they don't deserve to have a trauma-informed approach or trauma-informed care for the
Period.
time of ABA.
Yep. I absolutely agree. I think it's really important to name that it's for everyone. It benefits everyone. And if we look at trauma informed as essentially doing the opposite of what it's like to experience trauma. So if it's too much, too soon, too fast, not enough, not receiving, you know, not having choice and autonomy over your body and feeling disempowered, completely having your power taken away from you, your ability to choose your reinforcers and punishers in your environment, right? When we look at it from that standpoint, of course, why wouldn't we want to do the opposite of that? And I think it's also important to acknowledge that the likelihood of many of the clients that we work with, especially if we are working with autistic individuals, is the likelihood of experiencing trauma in their lifetime is higher than other individuals. So it's like, okay, maybe they haven't experienced that already, but why wouldn't we provide an environment where we're mitigating against the potential impacts of that and empowering them to advocate for themselves and take a neurodiversity affirming standpoint? Like it's intersectional with so many different aspects of, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, all of the things. So it's not just saying like, oh, we have to like make this environment trigger free, or like, no, that's not how life works. I don't know if you go through life and don't feel triggered. Like, that's just not how life is. We need to like prepare our clients for what life is really like, not just try to like set up an environment where they're never able to experience the full range of their emotions.
Absolutely.
It's setting them up in a safe way and making sure that we're present with them and, you know, that we're staying regulated in those moments as best we can. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, kind of on the note of making sure that we are regulated, let's talk a little bit about Breathe for Change. So, Breathe for Change is a program. Tell us a little bit about that and how the Breathe for Change approach. How it approaches trauma-informed facilitation.
Yeah, so Breathe for Change has honestly changed my entire life. It really has. I started the program about, gosh, almost 2 years ago. And this program trains educators. You don't have to be an educator. Like there's social workers, therapists, like there's a variety of people that join, but it's definitely more geared towards educators in terms of like social emotional learning and mindfulness. So this program essentially takes everyone through the 200 hours of trauma-informed yoga teacher training. We learn how to teach yoga in an accessible way and make sure that we're also teaching in a trauma-informed way. And then the social emotional learning aspect embeds the CASEL competencies throughout. So self-awareness, relationship skills, self-management. I don't want to embarrass myself on this podcast and not have them all five of them off the top of my head, but you get it. CASEL competencies. They're there in my brain somewhere.
I
So
love
we
it.
learn all about those. We learn all about how to teach different practices that are, you know, SEL aligned, but teach them also in a trauma-informed way, inviting participation, which has been like revolutionary for me and the work that I'm doing. It's just like inviting my clients to participate in something has been huge. Like they're just like, what? What do you mean? Like, I'm just being invited to do this? And then they're like, okay. You know, it's like that when they feel, and then when they say no, I'm like, cool, thank you so much for telling me. But it's really been exciting to integrate more social emotional learning practices into what I do as a behavior analyst and also for myself. They make sure that like the practices that we're learning are things that we can do for ourselves and for with our students. So it's widely accessible across adults and students. It's really fun to learn those things. So they make sure that we experience them for ourselves, that we're comfortable with them, and really get in out of our comfort zone to practice them with our students, our clients. I use them with adults too. So yeah.
I love that. That just sounds like such a great training. And you're still in the program, right? What's been the most,
So,
yeah.
oh, go ahead.
I was
Go
gonna
ahead.
say, what's been the most transformative part of your experience so far?
So, I would say, okay, transformative and like, it's literally like transformative teaching and leadership is the program. So it's like it's been everything. So the first piece of the program is the 200 hour, and then that qualifies you to become a registered yoga teacher 200 hour. I'm still in the program because I did the 300 hour certification, and then now I'm doing the master's of education. So they turned it into a master's program. I was like, sure, let's do it. Now I'm doing action research. So it's just like I like never want to say goodbye to breathe for change. It's like continuing to transform my life. But I'll say the most transformative experience was probably when I there like first started. They talk about like the zones of learning. So we spend, you know, most of our time in our comfort zone. That's where we're coming in contact with the, you know, more predictable contingencies in our life. And even if it's like a uncomfortable normal, it's our normal, right? And then when we step into the unknown, we're going into our stretch zone. And our stretch zone is where all of that like growth and learning happens. And it's so uncomfortable. And then our panic zone is like, whoa, too much. I can't, you know, can't learn anything, can't really be present for this. So that's like we're getting it's too, basically too much. And they talked about that like on our very first day. And then I think maybe that day or probably that first day, they're like, all right, we're gonna get into breakout rooms. And I was like, I gotta go. I was like, I can't do this. It was just like that like moment of like mini panic. And then they were like, remember, this is your stretch zone. This is where we're learning and growing. And I was like, okay, like I can do this. And then I went in and like it was uncomfortable, but that's okay. And I learned. And now it's like I'm facilitating breakout rooms, doing this, you know, like just to see that change in me to increase my confidence in talking about this stuff is just huge. And now like talking here with you, that has been absolutely transformative to understand it's okay to be uncomfortable and that learning is really uncomfortable. I think we just maybe forget a little bit once we become adults how uncomfortable it is for even our students and clients to be learning new stuff all the time, right? So that was definitely probably one of like the most transformative, really like aha moments for me.
I can definitely see that, especially like you're talking about, doing the breakout rooms. I know personally speaking, me doing those, I'm like, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah, I was like, I made a mistake. Why did I sign up for this? I can't do this.
Exactly. And even just kind of thinking about, trauma, some of my own trauma, and thinking about like having to deal with like new people, new spaces. Immediately that mask comes up. Masking is a trauma response for a lot of autistic people. And so it's like, okay, now I have to mask myself and make myself, fit into this mold. And the fact that you've been able to kind of like overcome that, you know, the fact that you've been able to do this and be able to be brave enough to participate in this program and actually like work through it really just is very inspiring because of the fact that, you know, you are going outside your comfort zone and you are getting uncomfortable and, you know, you're showing that it's okay to be uncomfortable too.
Totally. And when I joined the program, I was like really probably 6 months into trauma recovery and like really intense trauma therapy for myself. And so that was so huge for me to be in a trauma-informed space. And now in hindsight, I can look back and see, oh, that was so effective for me. I was able to learn and grow because it was a trauma-informed space. They did offer us clear context and framing. They explained exactly what we were going to be doing. They let us know, you know, these are your different options of how to participate. And if you truly were uncomfortable with participating, that was your choice. Like you know, it was the embedding of the trauma-informed teaching principles throughout that made me feel safe enough to learn and grow and participate. I think that's so huge for us to take away as educators, behavior analysts. When you actually experience it for yourself and experience trauma-informed teaching for yourself, you're like, oh, that does feel different when somebody just invites me to participate, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that this training also goes over is preventing burnout as well, which burnout, by the way, is also a trauma response. Trauma, you know, when we are burnt out by, you know, the weight of our load, the weight of our caseloads, the weight of our life, you know, burnout is something that does happen. That being said, how does the training support educator wellness and prevent that burnout from happening? And also not even prevent, but addressing burnout just in general.
Absolutely. So there's really wonderful research around the impact of mindfulness, and that's another piece. So all of the, the social emotional learning is all mindfulness based, which from a behavior analytic perspective, I can look at it through the ACT lens, and I feel really, really like good about that. I feel really good about using that approach because I understand the mechanisms involved in it, right? So mindfulness is embedded throughout, just really first starting, like everyone that was coming into this training as an educator was pretty much experiencing burnout, right? Like everyone's coming into the space and to see people go from like, oh my God, I want to leave this field to, no, I'm going to like make a change. Like I'm ready. I have skills. I'm ready to do this. So the most important thing I would say is that Breathe for Change makes the practices super accessible and quick, like not making it have to be an all or nothing thing, which is so important. I think for anyone trying to recover from burnout, is to notice our all or nothing thinking around what has to be our mindfulness practice, what has to be our self-care. Breathe for Change makes it very accessible, offers lots of options, makes it so that you aren't stuck in one way of doing things. And the practices really build your self-awareness, your present moment awareness. And when we can come back into the present moment, even for a little bit, it gives our brain that rest, right? Yeah. That rest from all of the stuff. And I think that's what's been so helpful for me is to just shift into like this idea of, okay, this is impacting my health, my well-being, my relationships, and it's impacting my work. And that's really what we looked at. We talked about that very honestly and openly and authentically, and having that really brave space to acknowledge like this is really hard. This is really impacting us. And then people were able to share their stories or experiences of that. And we were able to practice everything together, and that was really helpful. So instead of just somebody teaching you the thing, we're experiencing it and experiencing the benefits of it for ourselves. So that was really huge for me to just have that space and opportunity to practice.
Wow. See, and I can tell you right now, one of the things that I do within my full-time job is I work with candidates who want to become a BCBA or BCABA. And in our most recent group supervision meeting, we talked about burnout. We talked about how to address, when a therapist is feeling burnt out because of a client's behaviors. They might have a more intense response to behaviors as opposed to one that's a little bit more calmer and demean like you know they have like a more calmer demeanor. And one thing that we talked about was how we do have to identify like when to take a step back, and as supervisors we should be able to go in and provide that empathetic feedback when that does happen. Because there's this cliche of you can't pour from an empty cup, and you can't. If you come in and you are heightened from life or heightened from whatever is going on, chances are, your client is going to pick up on that. Your client is going to behave in a different way, and it is going to show. And so it's like having to identify when you start to feel triggered by something is that much more important. So that way you can take that step back. And that way you can go back to the drawing board, breathe a little bit, do whatever makes you, like fill your cup. One of the recommendations, even like two, is let's just say, they're in the clinic, we might have somebody cover. So that way, again, they can decompress and we can have a conversation in a couple days. So that way, like we can revisit what happened and we can work on identifying those steps. So I really appreciate hearing this because this really reinforces that lesson for me and reinforces the fact that like we do have to look at everything from you are humans first. You're not just a technician. You're not just someone who's on the
Totally.
ground,
Yeah. That's why I think it's so important. Like, I hear so many people kind of refer to behavior analysts and educators and superheroes, and I push back on that because I'm like, we're not. We're actually humans, and it's hard. Like it's hard, and it's not just like we're out here implementing these behavior plans and not being impacted by the work that we're doing. We absolutely are. And what you're talking about is that impact of co-regulation. Like our nervous systems are naturally wired to pick up on the cues of the other people in the room. And I know as behavior analysts, like that feels sometimes a little bit like icky to talk about co-regulation and all of that, but like it's impacting us whether or not we feel comfortable talking about it, right? Like
Absolutely.
if somebody comes in hot into the room and their energy is all up here, like of course we're gonna feel that. Like we feel those things, and our bodies are responsive to that because it helps and aids in our survival. If we didn't attune to the other people in our environment, we're more likely to experience something super unexpected because we weren't, attuned to that. So it's really huge to acknowledge that within your RBTs or your BCBAs that you were talking about, really making sure to acknowledge that addressing burnout isn't just let's address burnout between the three of us here in this room. It's like we have to zoom out and understand that these are the effects of, workplaces and society's expectations of work and productivity and so many factors, right? So that's where that it's important. Yes, let's do what we can on an individual basis, but then also acknowledge that like we alone are not going to be able to really recover from burnout if the systems around us don't change. And as behavior analysts, I feel like we get that, right? Like
We do.
we do need the environments to change. We can't just like suddenly recover from burnout, but still have a caseload that's totally unmanageable, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I also want to acknowledge too what you're talking about with like some people's behaviors will impact others in different ways, right? So that's that idea of, we talk about this in my trauma-informed training with one of my supervisors that I worked with for a long time. She's also a licensed social worker. So she's a BCBA licensed social worker. Erin Jeffrey, she's listening. She's really wonderful because she talks about the impact of countertransference and how in therapeutic settings there's this acknowledgement of like, yeah, our biases and our experiences are certainly going to impact how we show up in client therapist relationships, right?
Yup, that is in our code
100%.
too.
We have to address our biases. That's, yeah, that I throw that in there. I'm like, let's talk about our ethics code that says we have to address these things. And I share this too in my training just to like normalize that this is something like, because I experienced parent loss in grad school, that was really, really impactful in my life. And I had a client whose parent looked and sounded and walked and talked just like my parent that I lost. And it was so activating and triggering for me. I couldn't even do family coordination with him, right? Like, I was just like, I told Erin, I was like, I don't know what to do. I want to provide services, but I'm just avoiding this family, right? Like, I can't do that. That's part of my job. And she was like, let's take you off, right? Like, of course. Like, I just could not do my job effectively. And that's also part of our ethics code to address what's coming up for us with our mental health and addressing our own biases. And that was just, it was too much for me. I couldn't manage. And it's okay to acknowledge when things are just simply too much, especially when they're impacting to how we're showing up as behavior analysts.
It's very true. Biases definitely can show up for us, and we do have to be able to find a way to be able to address it, or we have to ultimately walk away from the situation. I remember being employed by somebody who there was a behavior analyst on staff, and she and I banged heads against each other a lot. And I remember that there was a certain situation that caused her to take pretty serious action against me. And I did not feel supported at all by my employer because everything that this person was saying was not true. I actually ended up writing a huge list of things of why it wasn't true, like I think 20 or 30 pages worth, just to give you guys an idea. And that employer did not support me. That employer actually had the audacity to say, well, you're slacking. I was a director at the time. You're slacking. And they also said that this person was doing good with her families, even though there was clear evidence that there was a lot of biases between myself and this person. Also, there was just a collective amount of like tenseness between us. And also, it wasn't just me that this was happening with. This was actually collective throughout throughout some of the supervisors that were employed at that place too. And so I found the first month I was like, okay, I'm just processing this. I'm gonna manage this because, I need to be brave for myself. I need to do this not just for myself, but also for my clients. But then I realized the less and less support that I was getting from my employer, the more I realized it was time for me to walk away. They attempted to even try to decrease my caseload so that way I wasn't as involved and even demote me as a director to just being a regular supervisor again. And while that might have been an okay solution for them, it was not going to work for me because it still meant that I still had to work with this person. And so that's where, for me, I had to make the decision to walk away because my bias was too much. I also had a lot of resentment towards the employer because of that situation, because I didn't feel supported by them. I didn't feel that they were doing their part in supporting me as an employer. You know, they just said, oh, you're slacking as a director, which I was doing the best I could given given everything. But that being said, that's also something that I had to really make sure that I was speaking up about. You know, and that being said, if, you know, if I can just provide some advice for everybody that's listening to this, if you have a bias, if there's something going on internally, you know, speak up and say something, because of the fact that even if it means, you know, you might end up having to change positions or change certain things in your life, it will benefit you in the long run. I'm actually way happier now than I was. And this was, goodness, it's 2025 right now. I think this happened like 2 or 3 years ago. So just want to put that out there.
Absolutely. I think it's so important to name that, because in my trauma-informed trainings that I do with folks, I have heard some of the most like just awful stories about how BCBAs and RBTs are being treated in the workplace. Women BCBAs that are pregnant and being like, you know, really gaslit into workloads and taking cases that are dangerous for their well-being. And it's like, oh my God, what are we doing? Like, yeah, that's where, you know, like you're talking about, it's like, it's not just the caseload. Like when I was working in kindergarten autism, self-contained, I was absolutely miserable. I was really struggling. I was like beyond burnt out. It was like a true, you know, acute PTSD that I was experiencing from my own life. And being in that environment, it didn't matter if you sent me more support, more like another person in the room. I simply was not well. I really needed a full like shift in my environment in order to prioritize my well-being, because that's what I'm concerned about, is the sustainability of our field as a whole, if people are going to just continue to perpetuate and be stuck in these cycles of burnout where people are leaving. People are done. People are like, how do I get out of this field? And I think that's where that understanding of, okay, we really have to start zooming out and make a concerted effort to move towards trauma-informed practices across the organizations that we work in, not just on an individual basis.
Absolutely, absolutely. I want to go ahead and drop our code word, our first one, which is BRAVE. That is BRAVE. That word is BRAVE. And, you know, speaking of bravery, you know, I do believe that, you know, we can be more brave, and we can definitely like do as much as we can to make sure that like we are not only addressing the trauma, but also, you know, to looking at our individuals, not just our clients, but our employees as well, our people as well, because, you know, as you mentioned, you know, we're human first. Four or five letters after our names, I'm sorry, I say this all the time, I don't give a crap about it, you know?
Right.
Human being first. And yeah, that's really just so important to emphasize and harp on, because of the fact that, you know, again, like we earned those credentials, but at the end of the day, when you are, you know, when you look at yourself as a person, you are a human being first. And we do need to be able to give the space for our clients, for our employees, for our own selves to be human. That being said, what does that look like from your perspective?
Yeah, so ACE to be human is something that I have just been really, really harping on for the last couple of years. And I think that comes back to, I've seen a lot of people go from the standpoint of like providing compassionate care and it being like this idea of, let me make this environment as happy as possible for you and for you to just be like as happy as possible. And it's kind of like going from the standpoint of like being trigger free sometimes, like just like really eliminating all of these things. And I've seen it kind of go, I think the pendulum swings really far, right? Like it'll sometimes just be like, all right, we're gonna like remove all the triggers and they need to be like happy and relaxed and all the time.
They have to be in HRE all the
Sorry,
time.
I didn't want to say it, but like,
That's okay.
it is. But I don't know about you, but I am certainly not happy, relaxed, and engaged all the time. Okay.
I don't think I've ever fully happy, relaxed, and engaged all the time. I think my mom's like that.
So it's just, I think there's this idea, and it's a product, I think, of so much social conditioning around, just this, what I think is aversion and discomfort with pain, suffering, and uncomfortable emotions, right? Like we are biologically wired to escape and avoid things that feel like a real or perceived threat on some level, right? And so if the real or perceived threat is our psychological experience of, shame, guilt, fear, sadness, grief, the rest of the human experience, then we're going to end up also avoiding that in other people and avoiding allowing space for other people to experience those in front of us. And I see this play out so much where there's this quickness to offer a coping strategy, offer something to calm this person down without just being like, hey, I see that you're having a really hard time.
Yeah. Oh,
I
yeah.
see you, right? It's like, here's this fidget. I'm like, hold on. Well, hold on. Can we just be here with each other and say, wow, I see you. I see that you're having a really hard time right now. And, I'm here for you and not run away. It's figuratively or literally, right? Like there's this, if we're running away from our own emotions and our own stuff, we're certainly going to, on some level, do that in the workplace. And that's where, you're seeing that with your boss. Or whoever, that person was like, well, you're just slacking off, you're experiencing psychological distress and being like, this is happening to me. And they're like, let me downplay this and escape and avoid,
Yeah,
all of that, right?
exactly.
So giving space for ourselves means to acknowledge our emotions exactly as they are without going in from like, yeah, I'm feeling really sad right now. And rather than just like immediately going in with like, but I should be so grateful because I have a roof over my head and I have a job, right? Like, can we just let ourselves experience the thing? And
Yes.
that's where that suffering comes in, because like being a human is hard enough, and from that ACT standpoint too, is like it's those that rigidity that we have around, oh, so many things. But just we're trying to escape and avoid the fact that life is hard. And the more that we kind of just like acknowledge that as fact, then we can start to show compassion towards ourselves, because we're just like, yeah, I'm just having a really hard time right now. How can I show myself kindness? And then when you start to do that with yourself more, it's a lot easier to do that with our clients. And
Absolutely.
yeah.
Absolutely. I think part of that too kind of comes from like a history of, being told, oh, you have to be okay. Like you have to be in
Right.
HRE all the time. And it's like, that's not reality for some of us. I know me personally, like I'm never happy 100% of the time.
No.
I don't think I've gone an entire day where I've been only happy and I'm only on that level. There is areas of suffering that, I feel, and part of that is just work-related stress. Some of that is due to Just a lot of like stimuli coming in at me all at once, you know, from my own caseload. But then also, looking outside of ABA, looking outside of my career, I have other personal things that are also impacting me. I have, you know, dogs. I have, you know, I have things around my house that I have to worry about, and, you know, people in my personal life and my social circle that I have to worry about as well. So for me, HRE 100% of the time really is not achievable. But that being said, you know, if we look at, you know, a situation, we look at somebody and say, you know what, like they go through things, they are human, you know, we can show that compassion, we can be, you know, we can be compassionate human beings if we don't just look at, okay, you need to be happy, you need to be relaxed, you need to be engaged 100% of the time. Nothing against HRE, nothing against all of that. But that being said, you know, we do have to look at the person as a human that experiences a variety of emotions, a variety of things, of a variety of changes that can lead to trauma responses. And one thing I want to comment on too is you mentioned that there was you mentioned that there was some stuff about the coping skills, and you know how quick we are to just be like, okay, here's a coping skill, here's a coping mechanism, here's this, here's that. And it's like, guys, can we sit for a moment before, like, you know, let's have them de-escalate. Like, we can acknowledge their emotions, but let's just sit and be present for just a second, and then we can go in, we can say, okay, look, you know, let's see how we can help each other. You know, one of the quickest coping mechanisms I see is take 10 deep breaths. And it's like, I'm sorry, but that doesn't help. It doesn't help a lot of our clients. I know it doesn't help me, quite frankly. But that being said, you know, it's one of those things that I see a lot too, is we have to use these coping skills and we have to band-aid the situation as opposed to address it, identify it, feel it. And then at whatever point you feel comfortable, then we move towards a coping skill.
Totally. I think I've honestly stopped using like coping skill because when we look at social emotional learning from that standpoint, it's like a preventative antecedent based strategy that you're just embedding throughout your entire life and routine. And you're starting your session or starting class with a social emotional learning practice. You're actually coming into the present moment, and that is decreasing the experience of stress for a lot of people. That is actually in some environments improving behavior, improving the incidence of like being like detention, like those things, like disciplinary action, things like that, in schools that are really implementing those things consistently. And yeah, I think we're so quick to try to like turn off this behavior, to turn off this emotion. And when we can just allow somebody to be, like, you don't need to be any certain way. When we can allow somebody to, that's when they can be authentic. That's when they can unmask, right? Like, if I don't feel like I can be my true self, that all of my parts of me and all of my emotions are acceptable around this group of people, I'm gonna have a really hard time unmasking in front of them. And that's the same thing for our students, same thing in the workplace. Like, we're having to hold it together for the people that we're working with, right? Like, there's so much emotional constriction and exhaustion that we're experiencing, especially like just, yes, all of that personal stuff, all of the work stuff. And then the like political environment that we are living in, the just all of those things, we can't downplay the impact of those setting events, those collective setting events, right? They're impacting us. We're seeing horrific things on our phones all the time. Like, things are actually really impacting us on a daily basis without us just being like, whoa, I feel scared. I feel worried. There's a lot of venting that goes on. Like, we kind of like go and we vent to people. and we talk about like, oh my God, I can't believe this happened and this was so annoying, but we never like get the feeling out. And so like if I could say any one thing, it would be to just for people who are kind of like, oh my God, okay, where do I start then? Fine. Just start to check in with like your actual true feelings and just let them be there for even just a moment to just be like, yeah, do the, like the with Breathe for Change, they call it a two-word check-in. And it's like it's a practice just check truly check in with yourself and name two emotions that you're feeling in this moment. Because like you're saying, happiness all day, our emotions fluctuate and they change just like the weather, right? So if we can name two emotions that we're feeling, you could just check in that way. Right now I'm feeling engaged and interested. And great. Those are the feelings that I'm experiencing right now. That's what's true for me. And just allow that. Just allow that to be, even if it's I'm feeling sad and stressed. Just allow those things to be once a day.
Yeah.
Just like once a day, just let yourself be. And then maybe use that with like your clients. Just how's this feeling? How are you feeling? And just allow those things to be. Let
Absolutely.
them increase that like emotional safety really with you. And
Absolutely.
modeling that, modeling more than just I'm feeling happy and or like excited or whatever. Like I will model with my clients. Like I'll be like, I'm feeling stressed and a little distracted. And I'm not saying why. Like we don't have to go into the why. We can just name it. If they really want to know, I'll tell them, right? I'm like, oh my gosh, well, this,
Tact, it's
yeah, I'm just tacting. We don't have to go into the why. And my
Yeah.
client doesn't have to go on the why. But it gives permission. We just need to give permission for our clients to be like, I feel bad and frustrated.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. And just let it be, right? Like it's maybe if they want to engage in a practice that would support them in that, maybe, but just let it be.
Exactly. Exactly. I definitely appreciate that. I feel like we can definitely do better in terms of that. And even to a lot of us are CEU presenters, myself included. And one of the things that we've talked about before is that many trauma-informed CEUs focus on client relationships, but don't necessarily zoom out to the bigger picture. So, for those of us who are CEU presenters and want to talk more about trauma-informed care and how we can provide truly compassionate, individualized care for our clients, what's your advice on shifting that focus?
I would say trauma-informed has to start with us and how we are showing up. Trauma-informed leaders, the Institute on Trauma-Informed Care, I would have to link it later. They talk about like trauma-informed leaders engage in their self-awareness, or are leaders that engage in regular self-awareness, self-regulation, self-management practices, essentially. We have to start with our own present moment awareness. And because what you were talking about earlier was like this idea of co-regulation and like people coming into the environment and impacting each other. If I'm showing up and I'm coming to teach and I'm really heightened and I'm really not present, it's going to be hard for me to mindfully to show up authentically, which I don't know if I can define that. Actually, yeah, but like that's a huge piece of how we teach from a trauma-informed standpoint with Breathe for Change is just being like really real with people, being really honest and authentic, right? So when we start with ourselves and really teaching in a trauma-informed way, if we look at how we're presenting the information, are we offering clear context and framing? Are we letting them know why this is important, offering an invitation to consider another perspective, inviting people, not saying this is fact, this is how it is, this is what it needs to be, but inviting people to consider another perspective and understanding too, when we're talking about trauma-informed care and somebody has never even entertain the idea that they could have experienced trauma and it could be actively impacting their life, that can be really alarming and very overwhelming. And that was actually something that I experienced, where I was starting to learn about different forms of adversity, childhood adversity, and I was like, hold on a second. That sounds a little too familiar. Acknowledging that, like, the information that we are presenting itself can be triggering for people, and how we are presenting it, I think that's important to consider. And then I would say allowing space for uncomfortable conversations. That's what I try to do in my CEUs. That's why I like having the back and forth, live dialogue with people, because from a trauma-informed standpoint, I also want to see their body language and how they're responding to what I'm sharing with them. That's a really important piece for me as a facilitator. If I can't, I've noticed that, like, there have been a couple trainings where I did it for other organizations, and like no one has their camera on, and I was like, ah, I don't know how this is being received, and it can start to stir up my nervous system, right? So it's just like, acknowledge how it could be impacting people on the other side. Acknowledge
Absolutely.
it. Yeah.
Absolutely. I love that. I think that's a really important point. We can definitely do better in terms of, just trying to get to see, like, the body language, get to see what that all looks like, from the other person's side,
Yeah. And like soliciting that feedback, checking in with people too is a really big piece of how Breathe for Change approaches trauma-informed facilitation and teaching, is just doing check-ins. How did that land for you? What was the experience of that practice like for you? Really allowing space for reflection, space to pause. Just before we move on to this next subject, let's just take a moment and just pause and reflect. How is this sitting with you, right? I think that's super important. I want to acknowledge too, trauma-informed care from this from like the standpoint of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association, or SAMHSA, really understanding the like those six guiding principles and using them as an anchor has been super helpful for me. And I think sometimes we miss the systemic and societal impact of different systems that are really impacting the experience of trauma on an individual and collective level. And that has been super important for me to name and acknowledge in my trainings, of like, it's all interconnected. We can't separate trauma-informed care from DEI and from neurodiversity affirming care. It's all connected. So it's complex. There's not like it's, we can't I think behavior analysts, like, we want like this like really neat checklist of things to do and things to change, but it's complex, and that's okay. The human experience is complex.
Yep, exactly. And speaking of that, I'm going to go ahead and drop our second code word. Our second code word is choice. Choice. It is choice. Something that we all need. We need to have choices. We need to have the autonomy to do so, because as you stated, the human experience is very complicated and we need to have that. Oh man.
Absolutely. It's more than just the ABCs, like, come on. Like, we have to acknowledge. Just zoom out. Zoom out is what I ask.
Radical behaviorism, guys. Don't just look at behavior on the surface. Look at all the other things in between, the environment, the private events, the other things that are going on. That's how we can, I feel like trauma-informed behavior analysts are also be radical behavior and behavior analysts.
Yeah, it's like it's through and through every aspect, and it's like I'm not going to ignore the impact of private events and the internal environment for
Absolutely.
people. I just can't.
Yeah, no,
When I did, it
absolutely.
was really dangerous for myself and really harmful for myself. So I'm done with ignoring that, right?
Yeah, let's do better. Let's make changes to really truly address things from all different angles, not just what's on the surface right in front of you. So
Absolutely.
that being said, how can workplaces beyond education and ABA benefit from really just having trauma-informed practices? I mean, I feel like there's a lot of things, but from your perspective, I'm curious to know how you feel workplaces can benefit from trauma-informed practices.
Sure. So, I do want to acknowledge here that the Campaign for Trauma-Informed Policy and Policy Pra and Practice, CTIP, CTIPP, I think I shared that toolkit with you. They have this wonderful toolkit on trauma-informed care in the workplace, trauma-informed workplaces. And they talk about, the impact of, on a collective level in the US, just the way that trauma is impacting the workplace, higher turnover, higher absenteeism, lower productivity, increased errors, the deterioration of the team culture, like you were saying earlier, that with that one person, like it wasn't just that one person, it was like affecting everyone, right?
Yeah.
And so when we adopt a trauma-informed workplace standpoint, that means that there are efforts to embed the principles of trauma-informed care into the workplace, into hiring practices, into team building practices, understanding and incorporating wellness initiatives and mental health initiatives within the workplace, and improving trust and psychological safety within the workplace, transparency, understanding that if we can't trust the environment that we are in, including the people around us, it's going to be really hard for us to feel safe. And when we don't feel safe, it's going to be really hard for us to want to be present and engage in that environment. We're probably going to want to escape and avoid it, right?
Absolutely.
And probably leave that environment, probably quit. So it is really beneficial for organizations, not just in ABA, to adopt those practices, because mental health in the US is it's not so great. It's not great, right? And it's really important to acknowledge that we spend so much time in our workplaces. If we take a trauma-informed standpoint, they can start to function more as like a stabilizing and protective buffer for people, essentially. If we can have a workplace where there's peer support, where you have a sense of community and support, like just feeling supported and like you can be yourself, where you can share with people this experience, that can also mitigate against the impacts of trauma, because people experience trauma oftentimes are feeling really isolated, and that isolation and the internalizing of their experiences get stuck, right?
Yeah.
And so if we can have a greater sense of community in our workplaces, inclusion, making sure that we are adopting DEI practices. Sorry, I know it's a hot topic, but it's not just for students and staff, or for students and clients, it's for staff, making workplaces more inclusive. Because like you were saying earlier, when we're having to participate in environments that are requiring us to mask and or just not accessible, that can create a lot of stress on our bodies and our nervous systems. So I think those preventative practices are really important to start with. And then you get increased engagement, increased retention. People are more likely to feel psychologically safe and like, I feel like that's a very good outcome. I feel like that's a good one to
Yeah,
have.
absolutely. Let me tell you, when you are in an environment where you feel not just mentally safe or emotionally safe, but psychologically safe, when you have all of those, and not even just physically safe, when you have all of those elements and you actually feel safe in where you are, outcomes are going to be amazing. So
Yeah,
much
they
better.
will. They just have to be. And I think that's so important to acknowledge. Yes, there is higher productivity. And I'm like, I feel like we should be less productive. That's my personal opinion. But I do want to acknowledge that trauma-informed workplaces, people are going to have higher productivity because they're more engaged. They feel more, like there's this impact and sense of purpose for their work, and they're seen and contacting that reinforcement. And so when they're feeling more productive, you have workplaces that like thrive instead of just survive. And that sounds nice to me.
Absolutely, absolutely. My last question for you, I know we've covered this, but I feel like it just needs to be emphasized again. What are some small, tangible steps that educators, leaders of clinics, or just leaders out even outside of clinics, can take today to be more trauma-informed in their spaces?
Or so to be more trauma-informed, some actionable steps. Acknowledge that trauma-informed care first is really complex and that there's a continuum. So it's okay to be like, right now we are trauma aware and we're like trauma curious, right? It's okay to acknowledge that you haven't embedded all of the practices. There's actually scales online where you can look at where you are on that continuum. It's okay to acknowledge that. So I do want to say, if you're like, oh my gosh, how do I implement all these things? It's a lot. There's a lot to start with, right? So just those actionable steps, I would say, to first kind of think of the four R's. So realize the widespread impact and prevalence of trauma, especially within the population that you're serving. So some people are working in like adult residential school systems, understanding the impact of trauma for educators. So like a lot of behavior analysts that are working in schools, like, do you understand the impact of trauma in the populations that you're serving, especially if you're working with different demographics, things like that? So I would say like just build your awareness around that. And then to start to respond in ways that really honor choice and voice for our clients and our students. Kind of thinking from that standpoint of like, okay, how can I amplify this individual's voice? How can I get their opinion and preference across? How can I give them a choice? So I like to use invitational language. I invite you to do this practice with me. If you are ready, when you are ready, would you be willing to? Would you like to? Rather than it's time to do this, right? Like that's it can be really like jarring, right? And I know a lot of people are want to be really parsimonious in their prompts, and so use your judgment on what makes sense for who you're working with, but consider how you're delivering demands and offering choices when there can be choices. And then just practice building your own self-awareness more than anything is what I would say. Build in just that maybe a two-word check-in for yourself. So really pausing. Maybe if you feel like closing your eyes, you could close your eyes and just I like to put like a hand on my heart and just like ask myself internally, how am I feeling right now? Just see what comes up. You could do a little weather report too. What's the weather like internally? Those are both brief for change practices that I like because that offers accessibility. And so people will be like, oh, it's cloudy with like a chance of thunderstorms later. And it can be like a fun activity to do with people, but just building in opportunities for you to check in with yourself, and making it a practice that's not just when you're upset, not just when you're triggered, but just like a daily routine, and kind of embed that into stuff that you're already doing, like doing it on the way to work or in your morning routine, just like popping it in there while you're making your coffee. How am I feeling this morning? Just checking in. Little things like that. And then last thing I'll say is just when you start doing that, noticing the impact that your environment is having on your stress level, and offering yourself some kindness and acknowledging that you are human and that you have needs, and that you don't just have to like grin and bear all of the suffering and just show up and pretend like you're a superhero. You're human, you have needs, and those are important to address, to take care of. So start there. I would say start with yourself before trying to be like, I'm going to change all these things. That's what everyone comes into my training. They're like, I'm going to do trauma-informed care for my clients. And I'm like, oh, well, you're going to learn a lot about yourself in the process too. So that's what they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize that I was going to be so called out in this.
Oh, I love it. I
Yeah.
love it.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you so much, Jessica. And if I can just offer a little bit of advice just from like my standpoint of being, in a position where I work with a lot of different technicians, a lot of different people in general. I mean, I think it is really important to really like make sure to check in with yourself because you cannot pour from an empty cup. It is very, very true. I mean, it's February 12th, 2025, right now, for reference. A couple weeks ago, I know that personally, I deal with a lot of anxiety and panic attacks. And I had a really bad panic attack a couple weeks ago, back in January 2025. And I remember just being like, I cannot do this. Like, there's no way that I can do this. I cannot provide supervision, parent training, or anything. In the state that I'm in, because it goes into impaired judgment. It goes into almost doing something that is against, like what you would normally want. And that being said, when you are checking in with yourself and when you are actually like, providing self-care for yourself, you are putting in the emphasis on yourself that, you are a human first. And I've been very open about my mental health with pretty much everybody that I work with, just because of the fact that I wouldn't be the supervisor that I am if I closed myself off. I'm gonna be the person that is like, look, right now I don't think I can provide you with the supervision that you need me at. You need me at a level of high support, you need me at a level of care, you need me at a level of, just overall like support as a whole. And if I can't do that, that I have to address that. And so for those of you who are listening, I definitely want to encourage you to do exactly what Jessica's telling you. Check in with yourself and make those actionable steps happen. Make your space inviting. Safe Space, the ABA podcast. This is something that I practice in my daily life. I definitely encourage and invite people to come to me whenever they're feeling very low or they're feeling like they can't do something, or if they feel like their emotional mindset or their physical mindset or whatever is just out of alignment. I want that person to come to me and feel comfortable in that space because the work that we do in our field is hard. Being a behavior analyst myself, this field is very like impacting in a lot of different ways. We experience burnout very differently from our technicians. Our technicians carry more of the what is it? More of the physical burden because of the implementation and and we're more of the like back end burnout where we get more of like the parent complaints or the concerns about what's happened during the session, also the re-off. So our weights are very different, and it doesn't mean that one is greater than the other, So it's really just that much more important to make sure that like as a leader, provide that space because Everyone is a human being first. We're not robots. We have to mask when we're going into sessions because we can't let outside life get to us. But at the same time, we do need to be able to provide that space for everybody there. So I just wanted to drop that in. So.
Absolutely. And I will say, like, the more that we model that for our technicians and our supervisees, for families, just to like be like I had a meeting with a family on like a very dicey political day in America, and she was like, I'm feeling really stressed today. I was like, me too. Okay, like we had that conversation, that real acknowledgement of like, yeah, this is like a weird time to be a human. And the more that we acknowledge that, we give permission to people, and that creates psychological safety, because otherwise people are like, oh, that person's just like doing so much. I don't know how they do it. They're just so such a hard worker, and like meanwhile they're suffering. So acknowledge that and model self-care. We need to stop just like normalizing burnout culture and start saying like, maybe we deserve a lot better, and maybe the tools that we already have as behavior analysts could be very beneficial for us. And acknowledge that when we need help, and that's okay. That makes perfect sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Jessica, thank you so much for coming on today. This was such a beautiful conversation, and I really just appreciate your insight. Could you tell us where, number one, we can find the program that you're enrolled in, and number two, where we can find you if we want to contact you?
Absolutely. So, my website is wellnessbehaviorcoach.com, and you can contact me there. You can look into the programs that I facilitate. I offer coaching and mentorship as well. And then, Breathe for Change, the website is, I want to say it's just breatheforchange.com, but let me double check. Yeah. Breatheforchange.com. Amazing program. I ha have had a couple people reach out and be like, oh, I kind of want to do that. And then they get into it. So it's been exciting. I think I might have a referral code that I can share with you too, actually.
Oh, if you do, please let me know, because I might
Yeah.
actually into this myself
It's
too.
amazing. Life-changing. Absolutely.
It looks like it. Oh my goodness. Well, thank you so much again, Jessica. I really appreciate your time. And thank you, everybody, for coming in and listening to today's podcast episode. I have been your host, Michelle Zeman. I will see you on the next one. Bye, everyone.